Good morning. It is Wednesday, May the 6th, 2015, and we are here today to review statewide assessments with Mr. Saxon and Mr. Costi. Come on up.
Mr. Chair, as they come up, just to note, there is on today's meeting materials a letter from or a memo from the Early Learning Division with some follow-up questions. If you have any questions, Mr. Mandel was here. Oh, there he is. Sorry.
Hiding in front.
So that's out there. If you want to quickly look at that and ask any questions of Mr. Mandel, he is here to respond. If not, we'll get started.
Okay. Rob?
Co-chairs Compton, Monroe, committee member Huffman. It's nice to see all of you this morning. Deputy Superintendent Rob Saxton, for the record. And were there some questions to answer? No. Okay. I'll stay on it so I get to jump right on it. Welcome, Senator Roblin.
Sorry about being.
No.
President caught me in the hall.
And today, talking a little bit about statewide assessments. Well, not to have too many of those kinds of animations this early in the morning.
All right.
So the first thing I want to talk about just a little bit is what it is that happens with assessment. There's a lot of discussion about assessment right now, it seems like. In fact, in my lifetime, quite honestly, I never thought that there would be a day when assessment became a political item, and yet I've rarely seen anything with the strangest kinds of politics as have begun to develop around assessment. It really is an interesting thing to look at and understand all the different components that begin to weigh in on this thing and the different factions that have opinion about assessment. But I also think it's really important for us to understand that assessment is an important component of teaching and learning. And it really is the reason that we have assessment, not so that we can have political debate about all kinds of things, but so that we can improve instruction for students. I think too often we talk about assessment as something separate from the rest of education without the context for the role that it plays in education. And today I want to start off by providing some basic context so it doesn't seem separate. To do that, I have to go back just one or two years to my days as a teacher. Maybe 20, and think about how I would use assessment as a tool to improve student learning, and I think it's the way that all teachers attempt to use assessment as a tool to improve student learning. And the first step was always to identify what it was that I wanted students to know and or be able to demonstrate. And really and truly, unless you start there, you can take yourself down a pathway where you're not teaching what it is that you intend for students to know. And so if you can identify what that is, write it down. Here's the list of things I want students to know when we're done with this instructional component. Then you can start off in the right direction. Now, today we have a set of standards in the state, especially in English, language arts, and math, which are two of the most assessed components of learning in the state, that are called the Common Core Standards. And those standards set out very clearly what it is that we want students to know, and those are set out on a trajectory of college and career readiness. We want to know that when students have moved through our educational system that they're going to end with a set of knowledge and skills that will have them be able to be successful as an adult. And so within that, there are subsets in each grade all the way down really to kindergarten that say here's what it is we'd want students to know about math in kindergarten or fourth grade or eighth grade that would have them be on that trajectory. And so setting that out is a really important component of this. The second step for me always was then to develop an assessment that would measure what it was I wanted them to know, so I would know if they learned it or not. And if you wait to build the assessment until you're partway through your teaching, you build an assessment that will have students take something that you know that they're going to know. Right? I can always build a test that will have students know pretty much everything that I am teaching them. What I'd rather do is create an assessment so that it drives my instruction. Because if it is going to test against what it is I want them to know, then once I begin teaching, I need to make sure that that teaching is going to, at the end, lead to them taking an assessment that allows them to demonstrate that they've actually mastered what it is I hope that they would. If I wait, I can go back and write a test that will demonstrate that they know what I taught them, not necessarily what they were supposed to know. And those are two really different things. And so it's important to build that assessment before you get too far into it. And in this, I'm talking about the generalist sense of the term around assessment, because there's all kinds of assessment, and I'll get into that in just a little bit, whether it's something like Smart or Balanced, or if it's an end of a unit assessment or a quiz that I might give in class. Then the third part would be to provide instruction, and I would want to make sure that that instruction is going to have them learn what I want them to learn, and I'll be able to know if they did or didn't once they take the assessment. And that instruction is very much driven by what the assessment is going to ask them, because I want them to do well on the assessment at the end, and so I'm going to teach in a way that will allow them to do that. So the kind of test that you build is really important. If I build a multiple choice test, I can give instruction that's going to ask lots of discrete facts. What year did Columbus sail the ocean blue? If I build an assessment that's around writing out some kind of an essay, I'm going to teach a much more broad kind of concept, like what drives man toward exploration, right? Those would be two really different kinds of questions, and I would teach really differently if I wanted them, if they were going to take an assessment that would ask either of those questions. And so those are also very, very important. And when you have good assessment, and you know you have good assessment, it's going to drive better instruction. That's very important as well. And then lastly, I would want to have the assessment that I give, once it's done, provide me with some meaningful result or some meaningful information about how well students did. And really, as a teacher, I want it to give me feedback about what my instruction looked like and how well I did and having students learn what I wanted them to learn. I know that I used to sit down and start grading a test, and if I found that every student was missing problem number 8, it would sort of make me crazy, like, what is it about problem 8 that I didn't do a good job of imparting to them? There's something about this that I didn't teach well. And so now I need to figure out, how am I going to go back and teach this so that they would never miss this problem again? And sometimes that would happen. Half a class would miss the same problem, and you knew there was something about your instruction, or maybe something about the question, but too often about what your instruction looked like. There should be feedback for the student. The student ought to be able to say, have I mastered this or not? Do I need to do some more work? How well am I doing? Or something for the parent. How well is your child doing as they're moving through this class or through school in general? And then, depending on the kind of assessment, there might be some feedback for the school or for the district. It depends. If I'm just giving an end of the chapter assessment or an assessment at the end of the day, there's going to be a lot of feedback for the teacher about their instruction and for the student about their learning and their pathway. If it's bigger, it might include a parent. If it's a school-wide assessment, if all Algebra 1 teachers have agreed that they're going to give the same assessment at the end of a certain set of knowledge, you're going to have some learning at the school level that tells you about your students got number 8 right and mine didn't. What did you do? How did you teach that? Let's talk about this so that we can improve our instructional practice. If it were district-wide, we're going to give an assessment and everyone in the district is going to take it. It might give the district some feedback about what's happening at individual schools or what's happening in the district as a whole. And if it were statewide, it certainly could give feedback about schools and about districts as they're able to compare from one to another on how well students did, and are there any components of instruction that they're not hitting on as well as they would like to.
Mr. Saxon, or if it's nationwide, like AP exams, you can compare it across the country.
Yes, Coach Chairman Rowe, thank you very much for that. It is true, and you can compare between states, or you can compare across the country, and you can also, on something like AP, where you have a very definite set of standards that it is that you want students to learn, you can really tell, what's happening in classrooms and in schools and in large components of the educational delivery system.
If your teaching isn't targeted to what they need to learn, you don't get a second chance.
Coach Herman Rowe, absolutely
exam
correct.
On one day, and they either do well or they don't.
So large-scale assessments have also been about a number of different things, and this is where the politics start to come into play. So are they about accountability, or not. So if you're going to evaluate how well a district or a school is doing or how well an individual teacher is doing, is that about accountability? And I would say, yes, it certainly is. Can you use the assessment to do that or not would be the next question. What about educator evaluation? Interesting exchange between Senator Monroe and myself just now about that. And can you say this person's doing a better job than that person? And how well defined is the test? And can you really do that? Is it appropriate or not? And then another question would be, are there some kinds of achievement gaps that we see taking place between different groups of students if you start to break things out demographically? And so those are all really big questions that we have. The important part is that we need to be able to adjust what it is that we're doing based on the result. And really, any time that you get a result or feedback about anything, if your intent is to improve, you need to embrace what it tells you and set out to try to improve what it is you're doing. Whether it is that you're timing yourself in the 400 meters and you want to change your training regimen, or you're teaching students and you want to change how you go about your instruction or about your program in general. So I do want to also acknowledge that we use so many facts here in Salem and really in school districts across the state on a regular basis that are generated out of assessment. It's rare for me to meet with any of you and be in your office and not have someone, me or you, give me some kind of a fact about something that's happening in education in the state of Oregon. Oftentimes, in fact, most of the time, those facts are generated right out of assessments that we get. How well are we doing with third grade reading would be one, and this slide really gives some evidence of that, where it would say that currently all students, 68% of all students in the state, meet the third grade reading benchmark. We talk about that often. And in fact, you know, we designed up a big literacy initiative, grade three literacy initiative, in an effort to try to get at this, because we know that when students can't read at third grade, they have a learning hill in front of them that is nearly impossible to mount. I mean, it is a huge climb, and they're almost doomed from that point forward on being able to be successful in school. This is an important data point for us to know. We cannot know this, and we cannot react to it unless we have an assessment that tells us something like this. This also tells us that our Latino or Hispanic students scored or are successful approximately 20% fewer of our students are successful on the third grade reading benchmark than are all students in the state, the conglomerate of students. And I can break this out on all kinds of different demographics and tell us something about that. Economically disadvantaged, 57% of our students meet or exceed on the third grade benchmark. And so if we know these things, are there some things that we ought to be doing differently then about the way that we instruct or about the way we allocate resources? What kinds of assessments maybe that we give? What can we do different so that we begin to close these achievement gaps? And there certainly are things that we can do.
Isn't it interesting that 68% is very close to the number that graduate on time?
Senator Monroe, co-chair, thank you very much. Yes, as a matter of fact, it is precisely the same until we made a couple small modifications to the graduation calculation this year. Our four-year cohort graduation rate in Oregon was 68% last year. This year it was at 72%, mostly because we made a couple of changes in how we calculate the rate. So very, very similar.
But I'll bet if we got that number up in the 90s for third graders, we would also, a few steps down the pike, get graduation up into the 90s.
Co-chairman Rowe, I'm certain of it. I don't know how in the information age children are expected to access information and content if they cannot read.
Senator Thompson.
Senator Rowe, does that mean we're going to fund that initiative? I think that would be good to do.
I think we should.
Great. Another assessment fact, and I'm just going to do several of these if I could, is just to look at the longitudinal time frame here in Oregon. So if we look at students meeting or exceeding in 2008 in fifth grade math, 44% of our students were meeting the benchmark. In 2014, it was 60%. Eighth grade math, 51% in 2008, 63% in 2014. And so sometimes we need to know, are we making progress? Because sometimes it seems like we're not, and it makes you sort of crazy, right? And then you look at this data and say, oh, well, maybe we actually are getting some traction. I feel good about that slide. It's not happening fast enough. This is one of the more interesting comparisons, and there are two slides about this. First one is the idea that we have two different districts. These districts are nearly identical when it comes to demographics, and that's an important consideration. If they're not identical when it comes to demographics, the comparisons get really goofy. And so these are almost the same size district with nearly the identical demographics in the district, and you can see that in one, 76% of their students are meeting or exceeding, and the other 50% of their students are meeting or exceeding. 68% again is the state benchmark. These are high poverty, highly diverse school districts, by the way. So the 76% is incredible. It's remarkable, right? They're besting the state by 8%, and their demographics are a much greater challenge than the demographics of the state on average. The other district, however, is not doing as well, 16% below the state average, and that looks problematic to me. When we look at these two districts further down the road and we start to look at what's happened in those districts from 2008 to 2014, you'll see that in District B, they have made progress in math in fifth grade and eighth grade, and they've regressed in third grade reading. So on the left-hand side, you'll see the thing that says change, the column that says change, plus 6 in math over that time frame, plus 1 in math in eighth grade over that time frame, and minus 2 in reading over that time frame. Now let's go to District B, the district that's exceeding the state with challenging demographics. You'll see that their math, third grade or fifth grade math, has increased by 25 percentage points, not 25%, 25 percentage points, which is pretty incredible. It means that 25% more of their students are meeting or exceeding the benchmark. No, 25 percentage points. And then in math, we go from 64 to 80, a plus 16, and in third grade reading, a plus 14. Those are really incredible results. I want to know what's happening in District B, or District A, excuse me. I want to know what's happening in District A. Yep. District A has got something going on. And if we could look at that and say, what are you doing in third grade reading because we're interested in creating a third grade reading initiative? We ought to be able to look at what they've got going on and learn from that. And in fact, if we could find 8 to 10 districts with this trend, we ought to be able to build something that that you can replicate and deliver to the rest of the state that sees these kinds of outcomes begin to change. And that 76% isn't where we want to be, but it is remarkable that they are where they are, especially I know this district and I know what they've implemented, and they've implemented components of what it is that we're talking about, not everything that we've talked about when it comes to the
And this is a low socioeconomic district?
Low SES district that you would appreciate.
Why don't you just say David Douglas?
I'm trying not to identify these two districts.
Okay. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This is the part that always frustrates me. We can look at District A and say, this is exactly what they're doing, so we need to replicate it. How do you go to District B with success and say, this is what the district is doing, District A is doing, and it works? Here's what you need to do this. There's not necessarily an external motivation for District B, I'll leave it at that. How do you translate that data and those plans from a more successful district to one that is struggling?
Co-Chairs Kopp and Monroe, Representative Springer. There are a couple different efforts that we've had underway in order to try to do that. One of them has been our focus and priority work, which has made a big difference, and another is you'll hear when we bring our presentations before you on some of the strategic initiatives about trying to do this at a district level. And a big component of it, honestly, is leadership. And it is a principal and a superintendent in a district office saying, let's sit down together and look at data like this and talk about what's happening where there appears to be greater success. And let's come up with a plan as a district that we can all buy into about how it is that we make this happen. There is a heavy-handed way to do it where you come in and say, now you're going to do it this way. It will move the dial, but it won't be long-term, it won't be sustainable, and it won't be deep. But honest and truly, educators want to do right by kids. And when you can come in and spend a little bit of time with educators and say, let's take a look at all this and have a conversation, and now set out to cause this to happen and provide you with the training and support to cause it to happen, people get on board. And when they begin to see success, there's a broad-based excitement that takes place in a district, not just on the part of the educators, but educators, teachers, community members, and pretty soon you're able to coalesce a really nice piece of work. Also, I would say that we have to figure out ways to incent that kind of behavior. I know that with some of the strategic initiatives that we've put out, we've said we have some dollars available that can help you improve in a specific area. If you want those dollars, here's how you need to behave. We're not going to just give you these, right? We have some expectations that are about what's going to happen in your district or around this kind of initiative before these dollars are released. And when you can demonstrate that that's where you're going to go, then we'll release those dollars. And I think that it sort of forces the hand, and then you have to do the work in a really intelligent way. It's a frustration of mine as well.
Is District B on there a focus and priority school?
Co-chairs Kopp and Monroe, Representative Springer, District B has several focus and priority schools.
I guess I do have a question.
Yeah, Senator Thompson.
Some of those things you looked at in A versus B, was that, I mean, didn't like third grade funding specifically for those initiatives that you and the governor brought forth, so Governor Kitzhaber brought forth, some of those were probably things that made that District A, some of those programs stand out, and wasn't that an attempt to focus dollars in certain areas, early childhood, third grade reading, some of those projects?
Co-chairs Kopp and Monroe, Senator Thompson, largely the difference between these two districts, I believe, was cemented in place prior to the 2013 funding cycle.
Okay.
I do believe that some of the work that we've done since 2013, especially like around focus and priority and some of the literacy initiatives, are beginning to have an impact across the state, and that we'll start to see those results in the next couple of years. A lot of the focus here was kindergarten, first, second grade, and those students are moving up, and they'll take the assessment this year in third grade for the first time, and I think we'll begin to see some result there. Okay, I wanted to show you this. This is a slide I think I've shown several different times, but basically it is the assessments that are given in the state of Oregon. The subjects down the left-hand side, so English language arts, math, science, social science, English language proficiency, and kindergarten, and then the extended assessment, and then how many students take those assessments, and then what the basis of the requirement is. And what you'll see on the basis of the requirement is, typically, I think English language arts is a great example, in 1994, the Elementary Secondary Education Act said there needs to be a test. And then in 1995, the legislature adopted the assessments that were eventually morphed into what was known as the OAKS, saying that Oregon agrees and wants to give assessments to students in English language arts. And you can see that basically that kind of pattern that follows everywhere down except for in kindergarten, the kindergarten assessments, which we began in 2013 and has an OAR attached to it. And then you'll also see on the extended assessment that Oregon began an extended assessment in 1995, and IDEA law was passed in 2004. And the extended assessment is for students with basically that exhibit profound disabilities, so that we can have an assessment that would determine sort of what their learning trajectory looks like and what kind of knowledge gains or skill gain is taking place over time for some students who probably can't sit down and take an assessment that we would all imagine as being typical. It would be more about life skill. My notes said don't show that slide until I talk for a second. I shouldn't have done that. So I want to talk about assessment difficulty for a second, because this has also become a really hot topic of debate. And when we began our assessments in Oregon back in 1995, we pulled together a group of people from across the state, and we created what we call benchmark levels to indicate if students were meeting or achieving our expectations. And when I say we pulled people together, it was parents, educators, community members, business people. Let's come together and let's set some benchmarks. What is it that we want students to know? And how high do we want to set basically the bar for students to get over to say that they're learning what it is that we want them to learn? And at that time, we had a real difficult time philosophically thinking about how we should set the reading and math standards at various grade levels, particularly in third grade. And there was great debate, because it's hard to tell a third grader that you're not on track with your learning. And it's equally hard to tell, maybe harder even, to tell the parent of a third grader that your child is not on track. And it's very much a policy decision where you set your benchmark standard. And in the end, in 1995, we set really low benchmarks in the state of Oregon. We said we want to make sure that virtually all third graders are going to pass the test, because the message that you're not on track is not one that necessarily we want to give, and there's all kinds of reasons for that. But a lot of it is about sort of the heart of teaching and saying to a young child, you're not doing as well as you should be doing. And how you say that and how it gets communicated, you know, sort of a number on a test, there's a fear that you may be saying to a child, you're not smart, right? And what we really know is a lot of time it's because children show up not having had some of the advantages and experiences that would allow their brain to deliver what it's capable of. And so there's a real question there, right? And now we're into smarter balanced. That debate becomes even greater, because a smarter balanced assessment is very difficult and challenging. And so there are lots of students that we're going to say this year, you're not on track. And is that the right move or not the right move? It reminds me a little bit of the debate about who should get a trophy and should you keep score, you know, when you're playing Little League Baseball. There's all these kinds of debates, you know, that come into place about how it is that are we going to make kids feel about themselves.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having eight kids and, you know, wanting them all to feel good about themselves, I can appreciate the conversation. Susan Castillo and I had a conversation right before she left for another job. And I said, I can appreciate what you're saying about a child's self-esteem, and we need to work with that. But I said, if you want to witness self-esteem issues, to talk to that child when they're in the 10th grade. They're virtually illiterate. They're facing a very, very tough adulthood, low pay. That's low self-esteem. And I think we need to find balance there, and we need to risk telling Johnny that, look, Johnny, you're going to have to study harder, whatever it's going to take.
Co-Chairs Compton, Rural Representative Huffman, thank you for that sentiment. It's one that I agree with. Maybe even the greatest risk of self-esteem is, you know, the 24-year-old who's in the basement, you know, living in the basement basically or whatever, and unable to, and really doesn't have the skill set that they need. And I would much rather tell someone they're not on track when we have time to do something about it, especially if we are able to deliver these messages from a standpoint of possible improvement as opposed to one of failure. And so how we think about that and the resiliency that we give to kids and the mindset of obstacle, challenge, and possibility are really interesting mindset kinds of conversations. And when we can say that we want to build resiliency and that really challenge, you know, the greatest successes are those where we actually have to face some kind of a challenge in order to overcome, if we can build that into kids, there's a great possibility.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This is your fault, by the way. I have permission to share this. And I take maybe even a little bit more intense view of what you just said. I think we do have to be nice. I'm glad you were nice. We do have to have these tough conversations, because people have tough conversations in life. If you're going to do anything, you're going to have a tough conversation. And I remember in second grade looking at my son's Dibble score, and he was a high at-risk reader. And I said, what's that? Don't worry about that. Your kid's good. He'll be fine. And yeah, the Springers were an engaged family. So his self-esteem was awesome, and he felt good, and I felt patronized and patted on the head. Fifth grade, when he comes home and says, why bother? I can't learn. This has always been hard. There's the self-esteem piece, right there. And it wasn't about mom and dad's self-esteem. It was about the kiddos. So I can't accept that we can't have real conversations. I can't accept that, because it comes with a whole lot more baggage later, and it doesn't even have to wait till they're 24 and still living in the basement. And it's unfortunate we can't have those conversations. Those were very real conversations, and they don't have to be detrimental, and they don't have to be heavy-handed. They're here, let's bring the support here, while things are much more easily fixable than down the road with private tutoring and all these other resources and bigger labels later on.
What,
that's your fault.
what we did at David Douglas in the 90s when I was on the school board, and we dramatically increased our graduation requirements, but we also set benchmarks earlier to see whether students were heading toward those higher graduation requirements. And if they weren't, if they were missing a benchmark, then we said to them, here's your opportunity for Saturday school. Here's your after-school program to get you caught up. So we didn't just say you're behind, but we said here's your opportunity to catch up. And the graduation levels did not go down, even though our standards had gone up dramatically. So you can do that. And but you just say to a kid, I'm sorry, you're behind, that's not acceptable unless you give them an opportunity to catch up. Who do we have over here? Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So can you explain what guidelines the state does provide to districts and or schools to help teachers be able to deliver this message in a positive way, so that when we, now that we're doing the Smarter Balance and we're anticipating that the results aren't going to be so great. I cannot support enough my colleagues here to my right about this sentiment, no reasonable person. I mean, it's so logical that we need to make certain that we're not only administering the test, but before they take it, that we're providing, it just seems appropriate for the state to provide guidelines. And I'm just wondering what guidelines we are providing, or training for the teachers or whatever, so that they're delivering this message in the right way prior to taking the test. It's okay if you say
nope.
We don't have anybody.
Representative Taylor, I know that we've put out a number of communications to school districts this year about assessment and some of these issues. I would have to spend a little bit of time to come up with those. I don't think that there's any policy or a program guideline that sets that out. I would hope that local districts would do a lot of that work around sort of their philosophy and their theory of practice, but I'd be happy to bring a couple of examples of some of the communication we've put out.
Follow up. Your lovely staff here, some of your folks, I've been talking with them about the teacher preparation and what the school districts are doing. We had some additional conversations about this type of thing, and also making certain, I think there's some room for improvement, so that when we're administering the test, that there's some consistency in fairness in the resources provided, so that we don't have some school districts that are able to afford all the supplements, and then some school districts don't have anything at their disposal, and then the kids are thrown in the same room. I personally will be questioning those test results when the same resources aren't provided. But then in addition, the how the teachers get trained and are what kind of guidelines are provided, so that when they're telling the students about the test, that those kinds of things are managed well. I'm going to brag about my own daughter's teacher. My daughter had test anxiety and is now loving taking the Smarter Balanced because she has such an amazing teacher. This woman is amazing, and she's somehow taken the kids and gotten them all to feel great. And there's kids in there that have some pretty serious learning disabilities, and she's it can be done, but those seem to be the exception and not the rule, and we need to make certain that everybody's getting what my daughter's getting, and that's just by luck. So,
Senator Roblin?
No, just that I think it goes back to some of the things that were said earlier, and that has to do with leadership. And we have not invested in leadership in our schools and on our teachers and understand this. And we've made the tests higher and higher risk tests for schools and teachers and districts. And it makes it hard then to, everybody looks for the other person to blame. We haven't done the undermining work, in my opinion, with all districts to get them to understand we really are doing this to help make kids more successful. It's turned into being about beating up places that aren't to get them to perform. That's never worked very well. You know, if you raise a child and you only beat them, it doesn't work very well. It doesn't make them better kids. They find out what they can't do, and then they have to keep testing the limit to find out what they can do. And so you have to build the system that does that. And I really, really strongly believe in that. I mean, you can't be a teacher and not believe in assessment. But you can be a teacher and believe that assessment is being done poorly for the wrong reasons, for all the other kinds of things. So that's, you have some people who are doing it right. I worked with David Douglas when we were doing Sim and Cam. They have been always trying to figure out how to do that in a positive way. They had a few bumps along the way. But the reality is they had leadership in that school district that said, we're going to help all those kids get there because at the end of the day, we want them to feel good about themselves and to be successful. That's not true. We haven't helped develop that in the leadership in all the schools around the state, and we need to really work on that. Yes. And I worry about which comes first. I agree with the beginning of this presentation when you say, if you set the standards after you've done the teaching, it's not a really good idea because everybody likes to do well, and you can do that. You need to set the assessment before you do the instruction. I used to have fights with my teachers about they'd be so proud they had a good curve, you know, a normal curve. And I said, you did instruction and you still have a normal curve? Obviously you had no effect on your classroom. They got really upset with that. But I said, it's the reality is if you know what you're going to do and then you teach them, you should skew the curve. If you really had any effect as a teacher, you should move the curve. You should show that you did something. So don't be proud of a normal curve. That stopped being a big conversation at our school because they recognized after they finally kind of figured out what it was. It's just that we'd been raised on normal curves are so cool. Well, when you do massive groups of people and you do a whole bunch of other things where you don't have control over what the outcome is, it probably will be a normal curve. And so I get frustrated because I really, really want good assessment. And I have gotten in trouble. My wife as an elementary principal has gotten in trouble because they sit in these conferences with parents and other people sit around not wanting to tell the truth. And we basically don't believe in that. That kids and everybody have a right to know with a right to understand that you're going to do something to help them. That's the big problem that I continue to see. We haven't figured out and we don't have enough money to do the things that you need, the interventions we need. So how do we get there? So I really love this explanation because I think people are getting a better understanding of what the whole thing is. At the end of the day, when we get frustrated because we haven't got all the other intersect done, we still go ahead and force it through, creating problems, I think, from time to time. So that's my biggest concern. And I really do appreciate the history as well.
Madam Co-Chair?
I wasn't going to say much today. But
I think Kathleen.
Okay. Representative
Thank you,
Taylor.
Co-Chair. This says it started in 1994. Obviously, we had standardized tests before assessments prior to that. Do we?
Co-chairs, Representative
Not that it's relevant, I guess, but
we did not have statewide assessment prior to 1994.
And was Oregon behind on that?
No, we were not. Okay. There were some states that had, like New York Regents Exam and some things like that have been around for quite some time. But statewide standardized assessments where all students took them as currently exists really began to happen. I believe the law was passed in 94. I think the first time students took the test in Oregon was in 1996. I was a high school principal at the time.
Yeah.
It was the first year that the assessment was given. We used to do some things that were like the California Achievement Test or the Iowa Test of Basic Standards. Or the NAEP, which is the National Assessment of Education Progress. But those were more randomized and like sample tests as opposed to all student tests.
Representative Springer?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You just started answering my question. So what did I take? I was out of school in 94. What did I take with my number two pencils and my five-page test, and what was the purpose of that, and did the state use those for any purpose?
Co-Chair's compliment, Rural Representative Springer. Oh, you're going to start getting into it. I don't know that I have all the history of assessment in the across the nation, but the California Achievement Test and the Iowa Basic Skills Test, I think is what it was called, are assessments that have a long history in the NAEP. And my understanding at this point in time, I will ask some questions and come back with better information tomorrow, is that those assessments were given early on, that they were mostly randomized assessments, so they tried to do random sampling to get a sense of where different states or different schools were and draw some conclusion about that, but that the idea that we would assess all students and begin to break things out demographically in a different way really came from a place of increased accountability. There was a study called The Nation at Risk that was done that sort of kicked a lot of this stuff off, where we said we need to know more about where we are and where we are with each individual child, all the demographic breakouts, and there needs to be a level of accountability for schools and their success rates. And that we were not getting there with the previous assessments that I described.
Senator Roblin.
So, having been one of those kids in the 1950s that took all those tests, my understanding was that for the general population in schools, all of them were taking it. I mean, in Washington, at least, I think everybody was in a regular school. So our populations who were not in those regular schools didn't take the test, so they were outside. We've changed education, so they're mostly in the regular schools now, so they would, if that had been the case back then, it would have been different. And in our files, they were always stuck there. So we had data comparing us to the national average. It was kind of like what you get in the preset test where you got it back. You got these kind of range of things that told about yourself, and I know that you had access to it from time to time. No one really spent much time with it. Some people who wanted to and parents wanted to know where their kid was, they go look at it. And we took those. It wasn't every year, though. It was like 3, 5, and 8 or whatever. But and I think they were used to look at state comparisons and to look at, I think districts may have used it if they broke it out that way. But I think you had to pay extra if you wanted to get it broken out by some of those other kinds of things. But it was an attempt to get it to some of the same stuff. Though the states and no one else had, it was the companies that decided what they were going to test on. And that made it different as well.
And I will come back with some additional information just to make sure I'm being straight here. So this is the slide that
Just very briefly, I too wanted just to share basically what Senator Roblin just discussed, that early on we didn't have these types of assessments. And just a very brief story that I did my student teaching in 1988, and I got a mishmash of classes, a speech class, a language arts class, and then I had this class that was called, some kind of writing. And nobody told me, I didn't have test scores, I didn't have any information on any of those students, and this one writing class, when I got in there, I found out that most of the students didn't know how to read or write. And I'll never forget the day the reading specialist came up to me, and she was just overjoyed because one of my students had written a sentence. Normally he sat there during writing time and was very patient and quiet, but he never really, you know, I had to really work with him to write out a phrase. And I said, yeah, Roy wrote a sentence. I was hoping for a paragraph. And she goes, oh, you need to know that's the first sentence he's written in his entire life. And he was 18.
Wow.
And, you know, it struck me then, it's like I was halfway through my student teaching curriculum. I thought, would have been nice to know that, you know, 6 weeks ago. But, I mean, so there is purpose and value. But as Senator Roblin shared, those test results were probably in his CUME file. And I didn't know what a CUME file was at that stage. And so educating our teachers is as big as a big component of this as the students learning how to take the test is what I'm trying to say. So it's a big combination of factors.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Senator Roblin.
I'll just say one last thing, because it goes back to personal experiences. I had, as people know here, I was this dyslexic kid, had a lot of trouble with tests in school when I was young. But my kids, fortunately, didn't have that issue. And one of the things we have to be careful about, I believe, in the standardized tests, and especially tests like we're doing now, where you actually are doing writing samples and stuff, we did that in Oregon, I think ahead of our time with respect to our writing assessments a few years back. It got too expensive because we were grading all these and teachers were grading them. But how the results come back, I think, really makes a big difference in how we keep the creativity of kids alive. So my daughter, who was really a good writer and had very good confidence because she had really good English teachers that taught her things, she would always complain about the graders. She didn't complain about hers. She got a lower grade, and she would say, you know, I tried to give the grader hints that I'm using some Hemingway-esque writing here, and therefore they should understand the complete sentences. Yeah, they're usually a good thing to do, but you have to understand, he set a new precedent on how to communicate, and communication is not about all the grammar that we think we have to know, and so if the grader can't figure that out, I'm really disappointed in your graders. I was a principal at the time, and it was kind of hard to argue with her because I couldn't argue with her about English language because she was a lot farther ahead than I was in high school. It is interesting because I think for some kids, that feedback back makes them believe they don't have as much confidence in their writing as they should. With other kids, it is the deal that says, you know, oh, well, I didn't know, but that's not her. So I think we have to be careful about how the message is delivered. And there are exceptional teachers who deliver messages exceptionally well to kids. There are others that say, explain to me why you did that. And they say, here's why I did it. And they said, well, that's a really, you know, I really like that, but here's some other convention. I mean, how you go about giving this data to kids is really important. And I don't know that we've developed that set of skills in our society and our teachers yet. So that makes me very uptight. I loved having the conversation with my kids, but I don't know what I would have been doing if I'd had kids like I was as a parent. I always like thanked my parents a lot for keeping me going. So those are just really important parts of this whole process that we're going through right now, and we need to learn from what we're doing.
Yes. Co-Chairs Monroe and Comp, thank you. So I'm just glad to know that from this point forward I can claim that my writing is Hemingway-esque.
That's right.
Whenever anybody wants to.
I was shocked about her. It was just amazing to me.
I wanted to, this leads right into it, and one of the things that we've got to know is that if we're going to use assessments to make determinations, we better be sure that we have really good assessments. This slide is some research that was done by NWEA, which is a wonderful multinational assessment company headquartered out of Portland. Who did some research to look at some of the benchmark standards that different states had, because every state had a different test starting in about 1996. Not every, but almost every state had a different test. And so, like I said, we brought people together and we set our benchmark standards in the state of Oregon, and we wanted to make sure that students were able to demonstrate they were being successful, in air quotes, successful. And when we began to do some research about where our benchmark standard was set. This is the math benchmark in grades 3 through 8. I don't have the 10th grade one on there, but these percentages that I'm showing you here are set against a nationally normed reference test, and so it would basically, all things being equal, predict that if you pass the test, it would indicate what percentile you would be at as compared to 100 typical students. And so it would be like, you know, a lot of people understand the idea of birth weight, or you know, they're in the 56th percentile of birth weight or the 98th percentile of birth weight or whatever. This is the same kind of an idea. It would be, what percentile would the passing mark tell you were at? If you pass, what percentile would you be at? If your birth weight was good, what percentile would you be at? Oregon's third grade math percentile was the 27th percentile. We basically told students in the state, and Representative Springer had a great example sort of about that with her own son that she just gave, was that if you met the 27th percentile in math, you were on track to be successful. Because if you're passing a test and you're a child or a teacher or a parent or a school and you've passed the test, it must mean that you're on track to be where you need to be. It must indicate that you're being successful. Unfortunately, because we were being so nice, and we didn't have the capacity at that point in time to even calculate this. But over time, as we gave the assessment, and we began to look at other assessments that states were giving, New York's was the 56th percentile. Kentucky, 58th percentile. Illinois, 50th percentile. Those states were reporting different levels of success for kids, and then they set out on a mission to improve on the percentage of students who were passing the test. In Oregon, if we didn't do anything, right, 73% of our students ought to be meeting the third grade benchmark. Mm-hmm. If we didn't do anything, 73% ought to be meeting, right? We were a little bit under that, but that's what should have happened. In the eighth grade, 65% ought to have been meeting because we were setting the standard at the 35th percentile. And so that's what happened there, and we began to indicate that we were having great success in the third grade and not as good a success in the eighth grade. Reading was even worse. We set our reading benchmark at the 14th percentile in the third grade. So third grade teachers looked at students and said, you passed the assessment. We must be doing a really good job of teaching reading at this elementary school. 86% of students should have been passing the benchmark without doing anything. And we were a little bit below that. We were about at the 82nd. About 82% were meeting the benchmark without doing anything. And then students went on to fourth grade and it got a little bit harder. And then they went on to fifth grade and it got a lot harder. You know, like three times as hard, right? And all of a sudden there were some students who had been passing in the third grade that weren't passing in the fifth grade. And then it just continued until we got to the eighth grade. And the 10th grade percentile was set at about the 53rd percentile. And so suddenly we only had about 50% of students passing the reading benchmark in 10th grade, but 86% of students in third grade, and we couldn't figure out what the problem was. And the bottom line is we moved students through the system telling them that they were fine. We didn't make a change in this until 2006. So from 1996 to 2006, this is what we had. In 2006, we increased the standard, but not enough. And then we had to increase the standard again in 2010. So students who are currently in eighth grade prior to 2010 took this third grade assessment and knew that they were on track. And they're in eighth grade today in Oregon schools. And we told them that they were on track to be successful. So the point that I want to make here is we've got to be really thoughtful about how good our tests are. They better be good, right? Because we're going to make big policy decisions as a state. We're going to make big policy decisions as districts, as schools, as kids, and as parents about whether or not our children are on track. If the school tells me my child's on track as a reader, I'm good. If they tell me my child is behind as a reader, I'm on it, right? There's going to be some tutoring and some extra reading at night. We're going to get some more books in the house. That's, you know, in my house, right? A lot of different kinds of responses on the part of parents, lots of different kinds of responses on the part of teachers and kids and schools. We better know that our assessment is a good one because we're going to impact children's lives, and education is economy. We better make sure that we've got it right. Which brings me to slide 10, Smarter Balance Assessment, Enter the Common Core. And now because we have a new set of learning targets, the Common Core, that were adopted by the State Board in 2010. So I want to make the point, we've had 5 years since we adopted the Common Core. We've had 5 years to make sure that we're aligning our instruction to the standards that are the Common Core. Those kids were in third grade, they're now in eighth grade when we started this effort. Right? We've had a lot of time to be teaching to this new set of standards and a lot of time to get toward it. Now, I will say there's been a rush to make sure that we're teaching to the Common Core standards in the last year and a half. Why? Because there's an assessment that people are taking this spring that is going to measure against that set of standards. And if we didn't have an assessment that measured against that set of standards, I'm not sure that we would have the rush to be making sure that we're teaching to the set of Common Core standards. And the target for the Common Core standards, one more time, is adult success. Students are going to exit school prepared for college and or career. And that's a really important thing when you know that education is economy. So you better have the right standard, and then you better have an assessment that tests against whether or not students are achieving at that standard. the Common Core set of standards. And that assessment for Oregon was adopted in 2013 by the State Board, which is the Smarter Balanced Assessment. And there are some things about the Smarter Balanced Assessment that I really like, and there are a few things that I don't. But the intent is to honestly know that students are on a learning trajectory track for outcome that would have them exit the system college and career ready. The results will be comparable across states. So 19 states are currently in the consortium. There are about 10 states that are in what's called the PARC consortium. And the PARC test and the Smarter Balanced test will be comparable to one another. So we'll be able to compare our results to about 30 other states after students complete taking the assessment this spring and next spring and into the future. So nearly 30 states combined. And we know the percentage of students meeting the standard is going to drop because the meeting standard's at a much higher level. But it's an honest level for college and career readiness and international competitiveness, which is also a really important concept. We need to make sure that the standard is going to have our children be internationally competitive, because your zip code really doesn't matter anymore as to what you're, what you know and what you're able to do, right? We compete on a global economy. And here's the set standard for the 11th grade assessment. It is that if you meet the benchmark on Smarter Balanced at a three, what's called a level three or four, there is a 65% probability that you'll get a B minus or higher in your next college, in your first college course in that subject. So if you pass the benchmark of the three or four in English language arts, and then you go on to college and take a class in English language arts, there is a 65% likelihood you'll get a B minus or higher. That's where the standard is set. It's not about a percentile. It's about, are you likely to be successful in your next step? And if that next step happens to be college, that's where the benchmark is set.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Rob. I'm sorry I missed the earlier part. But this is one of the things that I find most interesting. I mean, we talk a lot about our correlation about 40-40-20, about, we've talked in various ways about the need for remedial stuff at the college level, and this being part of kind of figuring that out more. Honestly, my question is, so if Smarter Balance has only existed for 2 years, the assessment, so where does that, correlation come from? What?
Yes.
I know you are not an employee of the Smarter Balance, whatever, but just if you can give us a little bit of a sense without going too far into the weeds about where that came from.
Co-chair, Monroe and Comp, Representative Smith Warner, wonderful question. There's a man at the Oregon Department of Education named Steve Slater. Steve is a testing statistician, a psychometrician, if you will. We have 2.5 psychometricians at the Oregon Department of Education. They spent a lot of time studying this issue, and basically they did a correlation between the OAKS results, our old test results, and NAEP, and which is the National Assessment of Education Progress, and how our students did on that. And then they also did a comparison then to the Smarter Balanced results that we did in the field test last spring, or the initial test last spring. I'm not using the right term, but basically the test that students took last spring. And then they did some calculations that would tell them when students scored a certain score on the OAKS, our old test, we can go back and we can say this score is 65% predictive that you'll get a B minus or higher. And it's about, so passing the OAKS test is a 236. We know that if you pass with a 242 on the OAKS, there's about a 65% likelihood you'll get a B minus or higher in your next course in college. We've tracked that previously. And we also know that the score on Smarter Balanced as compared to the score on OAKS is about a 242. So we used to tell kids you can pass at a 236. Now we're saying you pass at a 242, a much higher standard, right? And so kind of like what I was showing on that slide earlier, and that if those two things are equivalent, a 242 is a 65% likelihood of a B minus or higher. So it took a lot of machinations to get to that. And to get into the technical detail, I'm absolutely the wrong guy, but I know that that's how we did the work. I would tell you that this was a really important piece of work when we met as a consortium. So I met with a consortium of all the other state chiefs And what's called the Shia, the people from higher education, came to that meeting as well. And we had a conversation that was, what would it take for the results of Smarter Balance to be meaningful for you at the college level? What would you have to know? And they said, well, there would have to be a tie-in to likely success at the college level. And we had lots of discussion about what that ought to be like. In fact, we were supposed to vote once, and it didn't happen. I know you all can't imagine that. And then we came back together after lots of work and lots of discussion again, and we sat down and we had the vote. And in fact, the information that Oregon was able to put into the room about our tracking data was probably the information that caused this level setting to take place, this sort of 242. Now, they've got a different scale, and we'll use different numbers when we talk in the future, but really making equivalent to about a 242 put comfort into the hearts of chiefs, people in a position like me, and higher ed. And higher ed now is beginning to say, we're going to accept the results of Smarter Balanced and or PARC differently than we've ever accepted results from the Oregon State Assessment of Knowledge and Skills previously. In fact, we will certify that if a student takes the test, passes it at a level 3 or 4, these are colleges in Oregon and in multiple 10 other states, they pass it at the benchmark of 3 or 4, and they continue on taking a class in that subject as a senior, will guarantee them credit-bearing placement in a course when they matriculate to college. That's a really big deal. We never used to do that. Kids always had to show up and take an entrance exam, and sometimes they were put in developmental ed courses, remedial ed courses, and sometimes they weren't. Colleges in the state are saying, if you meet this benchmark and you keep pursuing your course of study, we'll guarantee you placement in a credit-bearing course. That is like a ground shift. My hope would be that as we're able to cement the validity of this assessment, that we'll get to a place where they say, we'll allow it for college entrance. You meet the benchmark, you keep studying, you have automatic entrance to U of O or Oregon State. Go Beavs or Ducks or wherever else it happens to be. And that when we really get to that place, then we'll have an assessment that's valuable, and we'll see many more students being enthused about taking it. I'm always impressed about the enthusiasm for taking the SAT because it's about college placement and scholarship. There's no reasons that good assessments can't drive that kind of outcome. And so it would be great if we could get there with this, if we can keep, you know, it's going to take some refinement and some work, but we can get there. So the juxtaposition between we want to make sure everybody passes and we want to make sure that people are ready is really different. And it sets a different level, and it's a different kind of assessment. This is the best assessment. The Smarter Balance assessment is the best assessment that Oregon has ever given. It's not perfect. It's just the best we've ever given. It's online. It's computer adaptive. There's multiple choice, short answer, and extended response. In fact, students are expected to be prepared to answer much deeper questions. And I talked earlier about the importance of the way you teach based on what you know the test is going to ask. So the idea of I'm going to teach you how to be successful taking multiple choice assessments and give you the kind of discrete information learning about when did Columbus sail the ocean blue versus I want to have you read these three pieces on exploration. This one about exploration of the New World, this one about exploration by Lewis and Clark, and this one about exploration of the moon. And I want you to write an essay about the commonality of events that leads to human exploration. That's a really different kind of question. And if I'm going to teach about that, I have to teach really differently than when did Columbus sail. That's an important question about how good our assessment is that we need to make sure that we're going to ask big questions, deep questions, and ones that cause students to think and pull facts and information together and create new information out of what it is that they've been able to read and do, because that's how we want students to learn in the classroom, and that's how we want students to teach. It's harder to do quick test prep. It takes good instruction, and it takes human scoring. You can't have a computer score that answer. Somebody's got to sit down, and they've got to know whether or not somebody is writing in a certain style, and that the writer's giving them hints that they're writing in a certain style so that they can score it. And that's more expensive, but it also gives us more valuable feedback. Which leads us to this. and part of probably what you all really were hoping I would just sit down and talk about today, which is how much is this going to cost anyway, Rob? And so here are the costs and our assessment budget and the resources that we're seeking from this committee and the legislature in general. And that would be that the Smarter Balanced English Language Arts and Math Assessment is $11.1 million for the biennium, about $5.05 per year, and that the Smarter Balanced membership is 3.6. So I want to explain those two things just a little bit. The assessment itself is really the purchase of the assessment and then the scoring. It's the purchase of the assessment, it's its delivery online, and all the components that come along with that, and then it's the scoring and the results back to us and some
breakdown
about
that. And who
does
the scoring?
The scoring is done by certified teachers that are hired by a company called American Institute of Research, AIR. Different states have used different companies, Co-Chairman Rowe. The state of Oregon entered into a contract with AIR. It's a company that we also worked with on delivery of OAKS, which has helped us significantly because we understand one another, we know the mechanisms, and we've had what I would call a relatively smooth delivery, knock on some wood, because we're not done. We're about 50% of the way in students taking the Smarter Balanced assessment this year. It is not perfect, but it is way better than I ever, my wildest dreams could have anticipated. I'll keep knocking on wood. There are some states that used open resource materials. Montana had to call the whole thing off. They couldn't make it work. Nevada's had really big issues. We have not. We understand our vendor. They understand us. And they're doing the delivery and the scoring, and they'll get results back to us within about 3 weeks. It'll take us a while to tell the public where we are.
Senator Roblin.
So is that the entire cost? School districts have no other cost to bear?
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Senator Roblin, this is the entire cost of the assessments. Districts don't pay any money to take the assessment. If we were going to do whole cost, like the teacher is monitoring students taking the test, if we wanted to start talking about paying for the instructor's time, and that kind of, then there's a lot of costs that districts bear. But if we're really just talking about, do you have to pay any money to have your kids take the test? No.
Material, what I would talk, not about the teacher time, but are all districts having the same experience with respect to materials to prep, materials to engage in as they look at doing their rest of their instruction? They have the information necessary to embed in their regular instruction the stuff to be able to perform the test better. Is that extras? Are there supplements out there that districts can buy and some do and some don't?
Co-chairs Monroe and Comp, Senator Roblin. Probably the answer to that is yes. I think it mostly is based on local decision. One of the things that came out of the 2013 legislature that I'll talk about in a little bit was some resources that went out to school districts. It was $2 million that were distributed on an average daily membership basis across the state for districts to purchase some supplemental materials around formative and interim assessment, specifically most, and districts went about that different ways. Some districts used those dollars for staff development to create formative and interim, which I think is a great choice. Some purchased from various companies like NWEA that I had a slide up from earlier. They might have purchased their materials. Some purchased from Smarter Balance directly. And I'm sure that some districts spent more than what they were given, and some districts spent less. And so there is some variability in that, and most of that is the state pretty much standardized it with the dollars that were available, and then local districts make decisions about how they're going to use the resources that are allocated that would create some local differences. I would also say that on the test front, taking the test, it's a technology-delivered test, so what kind of infrastructure you have and what kind of technology you purchased makes a difference. One of the hiccups that we had this year was for students who were using iPads to take the test or those kinds of devices, that if you had a wireless keypad, there was a problem, as opposed to a plug-in keypad. It's just, you know, I don't know why, what the glitch is or what it is, but that's the truth. And so we had some districts who decided that's how they're going to go, and then they had to get some wired keypads instead, which is, you know, a problem. But in the grand scheme of things, it's surmountable. So to continue on with this, then the Smarter Balance membership is $3.6 million per biennium. That really is, Smarter Balance is a nonprofit. which is really important to me. And it's housed at UCLA in one of their research bodies that's called CREST, not important, but it's housed at UCLA. That was a decision that was made about a year and a half ago, that once it was developed, that that's where it would go. And they're responsible for the test creation of and maintenance of a problem bank. So, like, they collect up the problems, they pay people to create them, they vet them, they run them through all kinds of checks where students take them, they run them through committees who look at them for any kind of gender or racial bias. Poverty bias, there's a whole bunch of different things. Any question is a question that's gone through a lot of review to make sure that it's a good and valid question and it's at the right level. So we have a membership fee. Then we also have some assessments that we in Oregon give, and you saw the list of assessments that we're required to give. So the Oaks Science, Social Science, and the English Language Proficiency Assessment, $5 million for the biennium. The staffing, supplies, and service, so the people at the department and the materials and supplies that they have is $4.1 million. We have a help desk that we contract with the ESDs with, and so it is that there are people close to home who can answer all questions testing related, $800,000 per biennium. And then the kindergarten assessment is an assessment that we gave last year for the first time, this year for the second time. We anticipate next year $400,000 for the biennium for a total of $25 million. There was a question that was asked about, are there any changes in cost of the assessment? And there have been from 2013 to 2015-17. What you'll see on the top horizontal column here is that we used to give the ELPA and the writing assessment and the Oaks in 13-15, and we're not giving it anymore. So that cost, that was $4.5 million, that went away. The Oaks, ELPA, and Smarter Balanced were $8.4 million in 13-15 because we only gave the assessment one time in 13-15, this spring, right? There wasn't a cost for giving it this spring. And then next year, or in the next biennium, we actually give the assessment twice, not just once. And it's $16.1 million. And what you'll say is, well, 8.4 times 2 doesn't equal 16.1. And that's because we've entered into a contract to deliver this. We negotiated a little bit better price for this upcoming biennium, and so $7.7 million is the change. And then the Smarter Balance membership fees, again, we gave it just 1 year, $1.7 million, and in the upcoming biennium, $3.6 million for a change of $1.9 million. And so the total cost change from one biennium to the next is $5.1 million. And again, most of that is because we're giving this assessment two times instead of one time, and it's a more expensive assessment for us to give than the old Oaks was. Some assessment items that are not on that list, and I'll hit these pretty quickly. One of them is the form. I'll spend a little bit of time on this first one because I know it's important to the committee. Is that we did in the last in 2013 out of the session, there was a budget note that said, "Here's money for assessment. Now take this $2 million. It's 1.3, and then it was increased to 2 eventually, and move it in ADMW out to districts so that they can purchase some formative and interim assessment, or they can develop their own or whatever they want to do with the resource, but it has to be about helping kids prepare to take the assessment, basically, and helping teachers develop assessments and learn to use assessment in a really smart way." And so that was $2 million in the last biennia, and if we were going to double up on that, it would cost $4 million to do the same thing in the upcoming biennia. We have not requested that, but I did want to make you aware that there was a budget note about that in the previous, out of 2013, and we did use that resource as intended. In order to do that, it would take another $4 million. The Spanish literacy assessment, we are asking, and you'll see a POP when we bring our POPs forward tomorrow, policy option package is what POP stands for, of $100,000 that would allow us to have and deliver a Spanish literacy assessment for students who speak Spanish as their first language in third, fourth, and fifth grade reading. I'll get into that deeper tomorrow about, you know, how you learn to read and that kind of thing and why this would be a good thing to do. We want to know if kids can read or not, not necessarily what language they read in, because a decoding skill and learning to read happens once, and then you learn language after that. I'll dive into that a little bit tomorrow. And then $1 million for, you know, that we've talked about an age 3 to grade 3 literacy initiative. I'm not sure where that stands at this point in time, but if we were to have that, we would need about $1 million to conduct the assessments so that we would know what kind of progress were taking place on the age 3 to grade 3 literacy initiative, so we could prove up to you all that this initiative actually is creating gain with an assessment that could demonstrate that for us. And the cost to develop and deliver that would be about $1 million, and it would be part of Senate Bill 214.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Saxton, do you have any idea what that assessment is for third grade at this time, or where is your department standing in moving forward with that?
Co-Chair Monroe and Comp, just about the assessment, Madam Chair, or was it about what the assessment would be?
Just how close are you to determining what the assessment is?
Thank you. We are not close to determining that necessarily. We've gone out with an RFI, request for information, about different companies and what they could create and produce. We've met with several testing groups. We have to be careful about that because we don't want to mess up any kind of a procurement procedure. But we've met with some different groups and some researchers and said what's possible so that we could understand first, and then went out with an RFI that was informed after those discussions. And then once we get that back in, we would go out with an RFP so that we could actually get proposals that would come in. We needed to have a ballpark calculation of what it would cost to develop and deliver something like that, and we believe that this $1 million would cover it. So that was part of our work early on. This is entirely possible. It's impossible within the time frame that we have. We would need to move very quickly at this point.
Okay, thank you.
And we have only a few minutes left, so we need to wrap.
Mr. Chair, I think this may be a good place to pick up tomorrow, given staffing, this is the budget staffing committee. I don't want to rush. I wouldn't suggest rushing through this.
Okay. Rob, is a good place to break?
At the pleasure of the committee, certainly.
Okay. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be a topic for an offline conversation, but I would be interested in knowing kind of your thoughts or the department's about indeed the continuing on of the science and social science assessments, and kind of, because those show up in the budget, but they are never really part of what we talk about in the big picture in education and where we're trying to get kids to. And so I'm just curious about the role that they either now play or might play in the future.
Co-Chairs Compton and Rowe.
In the next 90 seconds, please.
In the next 90 seconds? Okay, I have a head nod from Co-Chair Monroe. It's a really great question, and I would add social science into that. Social science is required by Oregon law. I think we have about 5,000, 6,000 students take it every year, and yet we do the work to have it ready to go because we're required to do that by Oregon law. That would be an even more interesting sort of conversation. Oregon has adopted a new set of standards in science that's called the Next Generation Science Standards, Next Gen Science. The current science assessment that we give does not perfectly align to the Next Gen Science Standards, and we will be in the process of developing a new science assessment in the near future. So we have debated internally whether or not we should continue to give it in the interim. We've at this point in time made the decision that we think it's a good thing to do. We've got to keep our eye on science, and the Next Gen Science Standards line up well enough with Oregon standards. There's still a lot of comparability there. And the other one was
science and social
science. Thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't understand but that's kind of where we are. So we do think the science is a good thing. Social science, I have a big question about.
And Rob, I need to know, there's a lot of talk about opting out in some school districts, and there's an opt-out bill that's passed the House and it's in the Senate. I need to know what impact opting out will have on our ability to monitor this assessment and to make use of this assessment and so on. So I need your opinion, your educated opinion on what's going on politically with this opt-out movement in some school districts and perhaps even in the state, and how that will affect our ability to move forward with more effective testing, more effective assessments. So,
Co-Chairs Conference Monroe, in the next 90 seconds or whatever it was. Be happy to do that. So, interesting article in the Oregonian this morning. Don't know if you saw it, about that very thing, where a number of groups in Washington, D.C. came together and said, we need to send a message to the nation that opt-out is going to hurt some, specifically certain subgroups of students. I mean, one of the problems with opt-out is that if you get a certain subpopulation of students to opt-out and no one else does, the comparability between students and the way that we try to make policy decisions that tells us about what's happening with student learning begins to disappear. And so if any sub-demographic stops taking the test and others continue to take the test, you immediately lose your comparability, yeah, or any opportunity to, obviously.
Yeah, well,
look,
I wasn't
from one to another.
I was asking the question now. Tomorrow would be fine for an answer, because I want to have an opportunity for us to ask you questions about your response and so on, Senator Roblin.
Yeah, and on the same thing, I agree that does, but at the same point, when it comes to statistical viability of studies, you don't need the whole population. You need a portion of the population. And you may have a harder time making a decision on improving a particular school, but with respect to improving the test and how the things work, the population needs to be much smaller. We use ends that are very small with respect to making those kinds of things. So in that same conversation, and in some school districts, because the N isn't big enough to begin with, we don't get any of that data because they don't have those populations. And so, you know, it's going to always be variable. But when it comes to improving the tests and making it more reliable, more valid for its use, most of that work is done even before we get the big tests with populations that are taken out to make sure you have a cross-section of populations. But it's not the whole group.
Right.
And I guess that same kind of information about with respect to how we improve the test.
And Senator Roblin and I in particular will be leading the discussion in the Senate prior to a vote and so on. So any additional help that you can
would
be very useful.
Yep.
We will continue this discussion tomorrow. Thanks, everybody, for being here, and we're adjourned.